This is WMNF Tampa. Stay tuned for True Talk.
Radio show hosted by WMNF, WMNF.org, and 88.5 FM. I'm your host, Ahmed Badir. Summer is traveling and is not with us today. On today's program, we're continuing to speak about what's happening in Gaza. Just yesterday, seven aid workers with World Central Kitchen were killed while they were in Gaza trying to feed starving Palestinians. Of course, Israel has come out and said that it was a mistake. Some are saying it was a deliberate attack and the aid workers are not safe there and they're calling for more protections. But on today's program, we're going to focus on UNRWA, which is the organization responsible for taking care of Palestinians since 1948. It stands for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine. And later on the program, or shortly, we're going to be speaking to the former spokesperson and head of strategic communications and advocacy for UNRWA, Chris Gunness. But before we do that, I wanted to actually play a package that kind of highlights the situation that UNRWA is in now and why the United States is defunding UNRWA and other donor organizations, especially at this critical time when there's starvation and famine taking place inside of Gaza in the middle of the war. What is this all meant to do, and what impact is it, you know, it's having? So
here is that they're about to get hungrier. Donors to UNRWA, the main UN agency that supports Palestinians, including the UK, withdrew their funding 10 days ago because of allegations in a confidential Israeli document that this program has now seen. The document repeats an allegation the Israel Defense Force has made many times, that the Hamas terrorist organization has been methodically and deliberately emplacing its terrorist infrastructure in a wide range of UN facilities and assets, but provides no evidence to support its explosive new claim that UNRWA staff were involved in the terror attacks on Israel, just stating, from intelligence information, documents and identity cards seized during the course of the fighting, it is now possible to flag around 190 Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad terrorist operatives who serve as UNRWA employees. More than 10 UNRWA staffers took part in the events of the 7th of October. Israel gave the document to donors just after the International Court of Justice in The Hague made an interim ruling on a charge of genocide against Israel.
Israel must take immediate and effective measures to enable the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance.
It is utterly shocking that the donors who accuse UNRWA of instrumentalizing aid, as they have done, are themselves weaponizing UNRWA. It is a violation of international humanitarian law. It's a violation of international principles. It's a violation of the ruling by the ICJ, which says nobody should squeeze international humanitarian aid. What's Britain and others done? They've squeezed the aid. And it's a violation, arguably, of the Genocide Convention, because it will devastate the lives of 1.2 million people who were on UNRWA's food lines even before the 7th of October. And that's going to get longer. It will undoubtedly, if unsuspended, lead to mass starvation.
Chris, you saw the package there, which actually I saw on Channel 4. It aired some time ago, but it's still very relevant today. What is before, for people that are not familiar with it, our listening audience, what is UNRWA?
UNRWA is a United Nations subsidiary organs, they call it, a body created in 1949 by the UN General Assembly, i.e. all now 195 plus countries in the world. It was a response to the 1948 war in the Middle East, which drove 750,000 refugees from Palestine. Those in the north went up to Lebanon, those in the northeast went to Syria, those in the east went to Jordan, some went to Gaza, some went to the West Bank. And to start with, UNRWA simply offered what refugees need when they're first displaced. So education a bit, but more health and food and medical services. But it soon became clear that the new state of Israel was not going to grant the refugees the right of return, which under Resolution 194 it said it would do. And indeed, it was admitted to the General Assembly, admitted to the United Nations on the basis that it would honour the right of return, but it got into the UN and has not done that. So as the year started to go by, UNRWA morphed from being an emergency relief operation into a longer term development organisation. So gradually we got three main tranches of work growing up. One, education, because the refugees' children needed education. Two, primary health care, because the refugees needed medicine, they needed clinics, they needed medical attention. And thirdly, relief and social services. So there were refugees who were vulnerable, they were disabled, there were people with special needs of all sorts. And UNRWA had created a relief and social services department, which dealt with these special needs of the refugees. And today, that's the three broad areas where UNRWA works: education, health, relief and social services. But as well as doing all those things, you have emergencies, because the Middle East is inherently unstable. And so, as you saw in Gaza, as well as doing these core services that I mentioned, education, health, relief and social services, UNRWA suddenly, when there's a war, has to suddenly, you know, start doing education. Sorry, it suddenly has to turn its schools into relief centres. It has to do food, it has to do water, emergency medicine, all those things. So that's basically where UNRWA is today.
So it's a mandate from the United Nations. And how is it funded? Where does it get its money?
So because it was deemed to be temporary, which of course it was meant to be temporary, the UNRWA was supposed to come out of existence when the refugees returned home and, you know, their temporary state was resolved, if you like. So it's always had this real problem. So it's funded on voluntary contributions. So member states, the UN, those who are concerned or involved in some way with the Middle East, with Israel, with the Palestinians, they give aid to UNRWA. But, you know, the 750,000 people I mentioned at the start of this interview has now grown to 5.9 million refugees. So not only has the number of refugees who potentially need services for UNRWA grown exponentially, because refugees have children and children born to refugees are themselves refugees while their status is unresolved, but also the needs of those refugees have deepened. So at the moment in Gaza, you've got, you know, nearly 2 million people who desperately need UNRWA's services. So that's meant that there's been a terrible structural financial crisis in UNRWA through the years, and that has got worse and worse. And it's been compounded since the war in Gaza by the Israeli political attacks. So what the Israelis have done is they don't like UNRWA because they think UNRWA represents the refugees' interests, and Israel does not want to see this 5.9 million refugees having the right of return to their homes in Israel, because the Israelis believe that that would destroy the Jewish supremacy, the Jewish nature of the state of Israel. So they've decided that they're going to have this three-pronged attack on UNRWA. One is a campaign to smear UNRWA, secondly, a campaign to defund UNRWA, and thirdly, a campaign to dismantle UNRWA. But I'm pleased to say that that is not working. The donors, having been told that UNRWA staff had taken part in the 7th of October attacks, and Israel made these claims, but Israel didn't provide any evidence. And it turns out that the dossier on which Israel was making those claims is dodgy, is baseless. And so donors are now coming back.
We're going to get into that in a moment about those allegations. But why do you think that Israel sees UNRWA as a threat? I mean, after all, they're taking care of refugees, feeding them, providing aid, providing education, taking care of things that actually Israel as an occupying power should be taking care of, the people in Gaza. But so why do they see it as a threat in the long term? And dismantle it.
Yes, in my view, the fact that they see UNRWA as a threat is wholly mistaken. It's premised on the notion that if you get rid of UNRWA, then you get rid somehow of the aspirations of the refugees. You need to ask the refugees that question, and no one's ever asked them. But classically, refugees have three choices. One is integration where you are, local integration. So if refugees want to stay where they are, they have that choice. Secondly, third country...
relocation. Yes. Type.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they could, if Canada or the US will give them visas, they could go and they'd have the choice to go to a third country. And then the third choice they have is the right of return. Refugees have those three choices, the right of return, local integration, or going to a third country. And Israel believes that UNRWA is pushing the right of return, which actually isn't true. UNRWA's position is the refugees have the right of return. It's guaranteed under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Every person has the right to enter and leave their own country. But we simply don't know what the refugees want because no one's ever asked them. And so it's a false idea that that UNRWA is trying to push the idea of return. Certainly UNRWA advocates and gives protection to the rights of the refugees. The Israelis don't even like that. Even those who are so horribly vulnerable in the present in Gaza, the Israelis are blocking UNRWA convoys, even though UNRWA is trying to get desperately needed food aid through to them. So that's what the Israelis are trying to do. But it's as mad as thinking that if you disband Oxfam, you'll get rid of poor people. I mean, it's just a crazy fascistic myth.
So Chris, some sentiments out there is that basically the Israelis see that UNRWA is a threat in the long term, because they're keeping Palestinians on the land by providing food, education, shelter, preserving their culture and heritage, their language. This keeps them there in Gaza. And many people feel that they want them off Gaza so they can take that land. Do you share those sentiments, or is there any truth to that?
Well, certainly what we've seen from the Israelis since the 7th of October is what appears to be an attempt to ethnically cleanse, i.e. to force the Palestinians out of Gaza, and let's see where this war goes. Because if there's an assault on Rafah in the south, where there are something in the region of 1.5 million people, it may well be that they will breach the wall over into Egypt, the Egyptian Sinai, in which case they would be forced out simply to kind of save their lives. So, and at the same time, you've got this genocidal attempt by the Israelis to de-develop the land. So you've got huge areas, agricultural fields in the north, which were once thriving orchards of various sorts of olives and oranges and goodness knows what, being completely destroyed. You've got all the universities in Gaza have been completely flattened. You've got schools being flattened, cultural institutes, food production factories, I mean, hospitals, you know, you name it. And it looks as if Gaza is being deliberately de-developed to the point where the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, the highest judicial organ of the UN, has said that there's a plausible genocide taking place. So yes, I think it may well be that Israel is trying to make Gaza completely uninhabitable for Palestinians so that they can move the settlers back in. The settlers left in 2005 under Ariel Sharon, the then prime minister, and maybe that's what the Israelis are trying to do. I think there'd be huge international objections, not least from the Americans, if that were to become the case. But on this question of UNRWA perpetuating the refugee crisis, that simply isn't true. What perpetuates the refugee crisis is the inability or the refusal of the parties to resolve the refugee issue. All internationally accepted paradigms for resolving the conflict say that the refugee issue must be resolved in the context of an overall political settlement between the parties, and the parties have not been able to come to a settlement, and that's what perpetuates the refugee crisis, not an agency that's giving them a bit of food and some education. Of course, that's not what perpetuates their presence in Gaza. What perpetuates that, as I say, is the inability of the parties or the unwilling of the parties to address that issue. It's a tough issue. Refugees are always a tough issue for peace negotiators, but, you know, that's what leaves the refugee issue open, not UNRWA.
Right. If you're just joining us live, I'm speaking to Chris Gunness. He is the former spokesperson and director of advocacy for UNRWA organization. And he was doing that from 2007 to 2020. He is now actually currently the director of the Myanmar Accountability Project, which is also a really important cause. Maybe we can have you on a different time to talk about that. But speaking specifically about UNRWA and the ongoing genocide that's happening in Gaza, you mentioned the ICJ. The same day that the International Court of Justice issued their ruling and their findings that there is a plausible genocide happening in Gaza, and they gave specific orders and provisions ordering Israel to provide aid and not to continue acts that would be genocidal. Israel distributed specifically to donor organization a dossier about UNRWA making allegations that some of the UNRWA staff members that are working in Gaza participated in the October 7th attack, and without necessarily providing evidence. It was just something that was shared with donors, which some suspected that it was designed to overshadow and distract away from the ICJ ruling itself that there was a plausible genocide taking place. Do you think that that was politically motivated to time it the same time as the ICJ ruling?
There is absolutely no doubt that this was a politically motivated attempt to manage the news and to destroy UNRWA. And we know that because the Israelis themselves, certain members of the Israeli political echelons, have leaked a document from, I believe it was December, January time, which made clear that there was an attempt to destroy UNRWA in a three-pronged campaign to smear UNRWA, to defund UNRWA, and to dismantle UNRWA. So we know that there is a political, an attempt to destroy UNRWA politically, because there's evidence that the Israelis are implementing a plan which they themselves have written and which has been leaked and is now in the public domain. So yes, I do believe that. And I believe that the first part of that campaign to smear UNRWA was very much the reason why, as you said, shortly after the ICJ ruling, and it wasn't just a ruling saying that there was a plausible genocide going on, Israel was given provisional orders. They had to abide by certain things. They had to stop the killing, for example. They had to stop inflicting mental cruelty. They had to let aid in. And they've done none of those things. And so, yes, this was an attempt to distract. And the other reason why we know it was a political attack is because Israel has produced absolutely no evidence to support the allegations against the 12 UNRWA workers that they allegedly took part in the attacks of the 7th of October. And that's been made clear by Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, who said that the Americans have seen no independent confirmation of what's in the dossier. And other policymakers and statespeople in the donor community themselves who defunded have said things like, we've not seen the evidence and we reacted too hastily. So it's very clear that, you know, let me tell you, I've been the object of many a smear campaign by the State of Israel. And when they've got stuff which they think will stick, they will put it out there. For example, in 2014, during the war in Gaza, they told journalists repeatedly that there were militants in UNRWA schools, and that's why they had to hit and damage UNRWA schools. But after the war was over, it was all investigated, and it was all shown to be complete nonsense. And that's why I said from the start that if the Israelis had any proper evidence against UNRWA, it would have been given to the donor community, and it would have been given to UNRWA. But in fact, it never was given either to the donors nor to UNRWA. So it's a dodgy dossier, and they've based this fallacious political attack on this dodgy dossier. And as I say, it's clear that there is a campaign because we've seen the campaign document.
So this, UNRWA, on either the day that they introduced this dossier or shortly after, immediately fired the staff in question that they were raising concerns about or making allegations against. Usually you wait for an investigation. Why do you think UNRWA themselves acted hastily, which kind of maybe gave fuel or some sort of legitimacy to the complaints that maybe there was some wrongdoing? What do you think the reason behind that was?
Well, we know the reason because the Commissioner General of UNRWA, the chief executive, that's the Commissioner General's title, Philippe Lazzarini, made it clear that he has provisions in his office to dismiss any member of the agency who he feels ought to take any action in the interests of the agency. So he felt, for reasons best known to him, that the best way to defend UNRWA was simply to dismiss these alleged conspirators with Hamas. And he thought that would end the crisis and bring this episode to an end. And in fact, it didn't. So, you know, to that extent, it was a miscalculation because donors then began to defund. But certainly he has said publicly that that's what he was attempting to do. But to be very clear, Israel, he's called upon Israel, as have others, to produce any evidence that UNRWA was involved in the 7th of October attacks, and they have never done that.
I mean, there's been a lot of claims about the 7th of October attacks that turned out to be false later. We heard about the beheaded babies, babies in the oven, so many different atrocities that there weren't any that turned out to be, you know, untrue, even debunked by Israeli media outlets themselves, and relying on dubious individuals after, you know, multiple investigations. It just, what strikes me is that the international world body continues to somehow give legitimacy or believe the leaders in Israel, especially under the Netanyahu regime. Why do they continue to defer and somehow either give them benefit of the doubt or and not just dismiss this as just some sort of propaganda to distract from their ongoing genocide that they're carrying out in Gaza?
Well, I think there are specific dynamics around the America-Israel relationship. I think the Jewish-Israel lobby is very strong, and I think Biden is very worried about any criticisms that he might make because he feels that will affect his campaign funding and other Democrats. You know how the lobby works, that they feel very threatened by the Jewish and the sort of Zionist and the Israeli supporters in DC and elsewhere. So I think that governs the specifics of the American response to this. And Blinken has gone as far as saying that they've not seen independent corroboration of these claims, and yet they continue to defund UNRWA. And Congress has now passed legislation which makes it illegal for UNRWA to be funded at least until March next year. So they believe the dossier for their own political reasons, and it was a huge mistake in my view because it makes them complicit in mass starvation, which is taking hold. So that's the Americans. I think as far as the Germans are concerned, which is the second largest donor to UNRWA, it's quite simple, Holocaust guilt. I think the Germans, again, are very much in the pocket of the Israelis because the Israelis are able to guilt trip the Germans. I know for a start, you know, when we used to go, when I was working for UNRWA, we'd go to Germany and talk to German leaders, particularly those in opposition, would say to us, well, Netanyahu came here, gave us a 3-hour lecture about the Holocaust and then demanded 2 nuclear submarines. And that's how they exploit the guilt, the residual guilt of the Second World War and the Holocaust. I think young generation Germans are rejecting that and just saying, well, we didn't do the Holocaust, we're not responsible. Why should our tax euros go to fund this war machine that's committing a plausible genocide against people who are trapped behind a barbed wire fence? You know, that has very scary resonances for many, many Germans. They feel that there is the country that they're accused of committing a genocide against is itself committing a genocide. I think that a lot of Germans feel very uncomfortable about that. And I think that for the rest of the world, you know, Israel actually is the spoiled child of the international system, has managed very cleverly to exploit the leverage that it has over certain countries. This, you know, anti-Semitism button, which is pressed every time anyone is critical of Israel. I've been accused of being a raging anti-Semite and a Nazi many, many times. And, you know, I'm clearly not. And the more that this accusation of anti-Semitism gets bandied about, the more they actually devalue the fight against anti-Semitism and undercut people like me who are genuinely trying to fight anti-Semitism. I went on all the anti-Semitism marches in London, and I made the call, as many people did, never again. But of course, the slogan never again also applies, well, it applies universally, but it also applies at the moment to the Palestinians.
So how have you been dealing with these, just this conversation alone, some people will just dismiss it as another form of anti-Semitism. Oh, you're calling out Israel. They're the spoiled child. They're guilt tripping the Germans, which, you know, by the way, interesting. They were wrong, you know, with the Nazis, and now they're wrong again on another genocide, type of genocide. It's like they can't get it right. If, as you said, never again should apply to everyone. But how do people, experts like yourself and others that are trying to hold Israel accountable, defend themselves when they're accused of anti-Semitism?
For me, it's very simple, Ahmed. For me, it's very simple. And that is that by, you know, reference to international law, the idea that if you criticize Israel, you're an anti-Semite, only works if international law isn't being violated. And the criticisms that I have of Israel are based very soundly on the Rome Statute, And if you actually read the Rome Statute, it sets out very clearly that the sorts of practices which the State of Israel, the Israeli army now perpetuating and now inflicting on the Palestinians, are illegal under the Rome Statute. So deliberate killing, using aid as a weapon of war, inflicting mental cruelty on a group. I mean, the list of Rome Statute crimes that Israel is committing now in Gaza goes on and on and on. You've also got the ICJ, where the Genocide Convention is clearly being violated. Otherwise, the ICJ would not have instructed Israel to take provisional measures. And on the list goes, you've got Security Council resolutions, which are being violated. The Security Council says that there should be no restrictions on aid going into Gaza, as indeed does the ICJ. And yet Israel continues to block aid convoys going to the north of Gaza. So, you know, my criticisms of Israel are founded very firmly on international law. And anybody who thinks I'm an anti-Semite should first of all produce evidence to show that I have said things or behaved in a way which is anti-Semitic, and frankly, there isn't any. And if you want to have a conversation about my criticisms of Israel, let's do so on the basis of international law, which is the very basis upon which I found all my criticisms of the State of Israel, and indeed of Hamas and the Palestinian side, because there too have been violations on the Palestinian side of international law. Of course, the vast majority of the crimes, of the international crimes being committed, are being committed by the Israelis.
Right. And what is the current situation as far as in Gaza with the food situation and the starvation?
It's very concerning because several United Nations agencies have said now that people, children in particular, are dying of starvation, that mass famine has begun, and that by May it will have become an irreversible fact. And the thing you have to understand about famine is that it's not just about a lack of food. It's about a lack of medicine, about a lack of nutrients, about the lack of an infrastructure in which mass famine can be addressed. Think of it as a sort of illness, and you address that illness by having proper food, proper balanced diet. All of these things are being restricted by the State of Israel. And what we saw after the attack on the World Central Kitchen, the killing of the seven aid workers, those aid convoys to the north, on which 300,000 people were dependent for life-saving food, those distributions have stopped. So, you know, think of Gaza. There's 300,000 people in the north, internally displaced people in basically a large IDP camp, and there's about 1.6 or so million in the south around Rafah. So food, when it comes in through Rafah. So, you know, it's relatively easy to distribute food around Rafah, though it's problematic because many of the roads have been destroyed by the Israelis. Much of the infrastructure, the warehouses, have been destroyed by the Israelis. But first and foremost, the Israelis are arbitrarily preventing aid from coming in through the Rafah crossing, the one in the deep south right by Egypt. So there's a huge line of hundreds of trucks just waiting there for Israeli approval. And the UN has a list of convoys up for approval before the Israelis, and they simply don't give approval, and they don't have to give a reason. Sometimes they say, well, there are scissors for children's hair, those are dual use, you can't let in those trucks. You know, it's arbitrary, it's very hand to hand, hand to mouth, it's difficult to know. And then there's a checkpoint just a bit, you know, a third of the way up Gaza, and the Israelis are preventing convoys going through that. So at the moment, you've got a very worrying situation where World Central Kitchen distributions have stopped, and the Israelis are blocking UN convoys from going to the north at a time of mass starvation. And that's why we need to see the Americans and others who can exert influence on Israel to step up, because children are literally dying of starvation.
They're dying of starvation, and the world is watching with inaction. I mean, you have Israel's not that big of a country. However, the entire world body and all these institutions can't seem to intervene. Everybody's like bewildered. Like, how are they able to get away with this?
Ahmed, the real problem is what? Yeah, I agree with you entirely. But what can they do while America continues to give $3.8 billion a year to Israel? There needs to be a proper arms embargo, because what gives Israel the power to impose this blockade is, you know, I've been into Gaza many, many times. There's a huge Israeli military checkpoint. There's a, you know, the Israeli military put a fence around the whole of Gaza. You can't get in because it's the rule of the gun. You know, the occupying power has simply established military checkpoints and built these military walls around Gaza. So until the military might of Israel is called into question through an arms embargo, and we're talking here about Germany, to some extent the Canadians, certainly the Americans and the Brits also. And unless we're prepared to see an arms embargo, we're not going to see anything done in terms of preventing the genocide that's taking place, and the starvation and the mass famine is part of that. So, you know, I hear what you say. Yes, we're watching, you know, it's the first time in human history that we're seeing a live streamed genocide. But what's enabling that is those states that are complicit in this genocide, namely America, the Canadians, the Germans, the Brits, those states who are arming the Israelis. And until anyone in these countries is prepared to question those and to actually impose an arms embargo or to attach conditionality, the European Union, for example, has economic cooperation agreements with Israel, and those are premised on the idea of human rights observation. So, you know, until countries that are supporting the Israeli war machine start to call in, you know, and to impose some kind of conditionality, this will continue. But mark my words, they, under international law, are criminally complicit in the genocide and in the mass starvation. And I hope they'll be held to account, because they should be, because they're starving as a result of their actions. Children and women, innocent men, are all starving to death as we speak in the world's first live stream genocide. And believe you me, it's a genocide of choice.
Speaking of international law, the United Nations Security Council finally passed a UN ceasefire resolution. That was where the United States abstained after working hard to change the language from a permanent ceasefire to a lasting ceasefire. They abstained, allowing the resolution to pass unanimously by everyone. But shortly right after that, they undermined it by spokespeople from the Biden administration saying that somehow this UN Security Council resolution was non-binding. The rest of the world says it's binding, but somehow the United States now says it's not binding and nothing needs to get done. Were you surprised by that reaction? Because there was some hope there for a few moments that the UN Security Council finally got it done. And if it wasn't binding, then why did the United States veto all the other resolutions in the past if it didn't mean anything anyway? Mm.
I did find it surprising to the extent that it's wrong. These resolutions are, the Security Council are international law, and they very much are binding. It's the resolutions of the General Assembly which are generally considered to be non-binding. But it goes back to something I was saying earlier, which is I think Israel is the spoilt child of the international system, and the Jewish lobby, the Israel lobby, call it what you will, has got its hands round the throat of not just the Biden administration, but any US administration. So I think there was huge pressure on the one hand on the Arab side, because behind all this is the Abraham Accords and America trying to bring the Arab states around Israel to a peace deal with Israel. But on the other hand, you had huge pressure from the Israelis to carry on the bombing and to, they say, destroy Hamas, which of course is an impossible objective. And they say that they need to keep the military pressure up to get the hostages out. And of course, the Hamas counterargument is that hostages are being killed by these indiscriminate and disproportionate bombings. So yes, I was surprised to the extent that it was a clear misinterpretation of the status of international law. But on the other hand, it was no surprise that America carried on taking the side of Israel in defiance of international law and making the Americans complicit in genocide and mass starvation.
But doesn't this undermine these international institutions like the UN, the Security Council? Just
absolutely,
you know, yeah. Russia can just say, "Well, we don't have to follow any, you know, international body." So it undermines it, and it just sends the wrong message. If everybody's trying to work within the system, and the Palestinian, you know, representatives are trying and appealing, and the Middle Eastern countries and these different bodies are going to the United Nations trying to resolve, because this is This is the world order. This is how things are supposed to get resolved. But it just seems like this sends a message to the rest of the world that none of that is, these democratic institutions are meaningless. These international bodies and conventions are meaningless. It's whoever has the most power and whoever uses violence, that violence is the answer. So how is it that these Western countries and the United States and the Europeans think that they can urge more countries to join the democratic realm and put down their weapons when they're just simply sending the wrong message that, hey, violence is the way that you get things done, because they're supporting the violence that Israel is carrying out against the Palestinians?
Well, I agree with the premise of your question, which is that I think this is an attack on multilateralism itself, and certainly on international law. If Israel is allowed to go into Gaza and commit this plausible genocide, on what basis are we going to say that Putin shouldn't be destroying hospitals in Mariupol and laying waste the eastern Donbass? On what basis are we going to say that Putin should not be sending rockets into built-up residential areas of Kiev? There is no basis. So I think what we're seeing is an attack, and the Americans are allowing this. I mean, look at the attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus. Diplomatic premises not bound by the Vienna Convention? Was there not an obligation to make accusations, investigate, to protest about the abuse of diplomatic premises under the convention, which it, you know, the convention provides for, rather than just blowing up a diplomatic mission? So no. The one thing I would say, though, Ahmed, is that the ICC, the International Criminal Court, is investigating. And whereas the ICJ adjudicates disputes between states, it's a very high-level thing, the ICC is there to do criminal investigations, as its title suggests, for personal criminal liability. Now, let's look at the example of the former Yugoslavia, the Balkans. Right. You had Slobodan Milosevic, you had Radovan Karic, Ratko Mladic, a whole bunch of war criminals who were, I was in the UN at that time in the Balkans in the mid-90s, and we were all saying, oh, my Lord, it's terrible because look at these people. They're committing these crimes with a complete impunity. Well, the wheels of international law turned very slowly. And what happened was they became politically dispensable. And the European Union said to these newly emerging Balkan states, if you want to join the EU, get your hands on all those lovely preferential trading agreements and stuff, you're going to have to hand over Slobodan Milosevic and Karadzic and Mladic. And guess what? They were handed over, they were put on trial in The Hague, and they were found guilty. They ended their lives as war criminals. And, you know, history does, you know, the Soviet Union fell in a matter of 6 weeks. Things change very quickly. Israel is a very small country. It needs the support of the outside world, and the outside world can start making demands. And maybe when Netanyahu becomes politically dispensable, they will start, these states will start talking about handing him over to international justice. It sounds very far-fetched at the moment. But, you know, it's not over till it's over. So let's,
I mean, there are accusations against the ICC that they're dragging their feet. They're not treating the situation in Palestine and Gaza with the same seriousness and urgency as they did with Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah,
I just feel like these international institutions are going to be deemed unnecessary by so many different groups or dictators or even terrorist groups or people that have tried the democratic route and saw that it doesn't lead to anything at the end, that one group continues to use violence and the only way to respond to violence is with other violence. So it makes our world less safe. And of course, as an American, I also worry that by standing with and, you know, our country being complicit with genocide, that somehow that will turn the attention of would-be attackers on the United States itself, because they see the complicity in funding the genocide. I mean, when you've killed, when 30, you know, over 30,000 people, including children, have been killed, and then, you know, if you're a person in Gaza and your entire family has been killed, you've got nothing left. You're not going to have much love for the Israelis that killed your family or the Americans that funded the bombing and were providing the cover. So I just feel like it's just going to be a whole new generation of potential down the line of backlash. That's
good. Yes, I mean, first of all, to look at that question within the context of Israel-Palestine, this idea that this action is defeating Hamas, we all know it's the reverse. For every Hamas fighter that is killed, I've been to Gaza, I speak to people in Gaza a lot, and there is a newly radicalized younger generation. And the irony is UNRWA, through its education programs, is one of the few organizations with this massive reach in teaching values of all sorts to children across the Gaza Strip. And yet, you know, that's the very organization which the Israelis are trying to destroy, and the Americans are complicit in that destruction by defunding the agency to the tune of $350 million. So yes, I think that within the context of Israel-Palestine, I think this action sets back the prospects of peace a very long way, because there's a newly radicalized generation inside Gaza. And I think the repercussions of that will be felt not just in the Middle East, but way beyond. And I think, you know, once the fighting calms down in Gaza, we're going to see all sorts of incidents elsewhere in the world. But I think the larger picture is that there's huge resentment against America. It's not for no reason that the nickname Genocide Joe has caught on. And, you know, to be very clear, for many people in the global south, the Palestinian issue is the last unresolved colonial struggle. It's as simple as that. And America is supporting a genocidal colonial struggle, and very palpably. I mean, not only did they give the money to the Israeli war machine, but they've given them diplomatic protection in the Security Council for so many months to continue with this genocidal military campaign. So I think, yes, there will be a day of reckoning, just as there was for the American attack and invasion of Afghanistan, Iraq and others. I fear that there will be consequences for this. There always are. Violence begets violence. And I fear that what we're seeing is the generating of a huge amount of stored up violence, which at some stage will sadly, and really I say this in complete sadness and regret, I fear that this will at some stage come out. And I think America and Americans and Israelis are going to pay a huge price for this.
Yeah, that is a real concern. My other concern is that later on, the pundits and the politicians will just simply dismiss this, that radicalization is because they're Arab or because they're Muslim, when in reality, the people that radicalize these young people are actually the Israelis and their actions. It's not because they're the Arabs or the Palestinians or that they're inherently violent or they come from a culture of violence or a culture of hate, as Netanyahu and many Israelis would say, that these young people are actually taught to hate Jews. But if all they see is violence from people that are wearing the badges of the Star of David, and the only time they run into Israelis is when they're beating them or killing them, they're going to be radicalized because of that, not because of who they are or their ethnicity or their religion.
And also I push back against this idea. Yeah, I mean, I push back against this idea that, you know, Arabs are being radicalized, Palestinians are radical. Israel is incredibly radical and has become deeply radicalized over the years. You've now got the most far-right, fascistic, deeply Zionist, radical Zionist government in Israel. You've got ministers openly calling for Gaza to be, or you've got public officials openly calling for Gaza to be turned into Auschwitz. You've got ministers calling for a nuclear bomb to be dropped on Gaza. You've got the president saying that there's no difference between ordinary civilians in Gaza and terrorists, which is part of the dehumanization that accompanies genocide. You've got the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, saying that there should be a total blockade, no food, no water, no fuel, no medicine, no nothing. Again, that's part of the genocide. And you've got Mr. Netanyahu invoking the biblical Amalek genocide, you know. And so let's talk about radicalization in Israel too, because that is, I think, perhaps the bigger problem here, that you've got a deeply radicalized, both radicalized government, but an increasingly radicalized population. Opinion poll after opinion poll within Israel shows that there's public support for genocide. I call that radical. I call that a violent population. So, you know, you can talk about Arab radicalization for all you like, but this is being generated by Israeli Jewish radicalization too.
Right. I mean, it's more of, on the Israeli side, it seemed like a type of indoctrination of this ideology of Zionism, which now people are equating to some sort of racism or, you know, being a superior ethnicity, definitely more superior than the Arabs, and having to look at that. Now, obviously, in the United States, Zionism is not viewed that way. And anytime that anyone brings that up, they're accused of anti-Semitism. But I wanted to move on, and just before, you know, we wrap up, just yesterday, there was this attack on World Central Kitchen staff that were providing aid there. What's the World Central, from, I know it's not UNRWA, but what is World Central Kitchen doing in Gaza, and what were they trying to do? And is that because UNRWA doesn't have enough funding? I know that they're bringing some ships, and somehow they brought tons of food via ship route. What were they doing there, and what was their mission, and what happened with the attack?
So World Central Kitchen is a Spanish organization which is headed up by a celebrity chef, Chef Andrea. And he is someone who's very committed to taking food wherever it's needed. And so he and the Americans and the Israelis and to some extent the Palestinians and the UN certainly were involved in talks in Cyprus about establishing a shipping lane, a maritime corridor from Larnaca, the port of Larnaca in Cyprus, to northern Gaza. And actually throughout, almost throughout, going back to October, the Israelis allowed World Food Kitchen to have dozens and dozens of food kitchens in the north of Gaza. And with Israeli understanding, complicity, call it what you will, they established not just the maritime route from Cyprus, but also land routes. So the Israelis established exactly where the World Food Kitchen convoys would drive, the cars, the vehicles, all of that was pre-arranged with the Israelis, because they realized, as the occupying power, it was incumbent upon them to feed people. You know, they didn't want to be seen to be starving out hundreds of thousands of people in northern Gaza. So they allowed this operation to take place. And I actually do not know why they did this attack. I mean, it was not just one attack, it was three vehicles. And this, to be clear, the Israelis knew the GPS coordinates of every millimeter of road that those convoys were going along, because they were all pre-agreed with the Israelis. The convoys were themselves what they call coordinated, which means that World Central Kitchens told the Israelis at a certain time, this vehicle with these people in it, with this registration number, would be going along this road. They hit the first vehicle. And then when people who were wounded and dying were trying to get from the first vehicle into the second vehicle, they then hit the second vehicle, even though they had the precise GPS coordinates of those vehicles. And then when the people from the second vehicle, who were just about alive, wounded, whatever, trying to tame to the third vehicle, they then blew up the third vehicle, even though they were all clearly marked with the logo of World Food Kitchen, so World Central Kitchen. So, you know, Netanyahu has said that it will be transparently and independently investigated. What I say is, what about a transparent and independent investigation into the 171 UNRWA workers who were killed? And what about a transparent investigation into the 32,000 Palestinians who've been killed in circumstances which are far from clear? It's far from clear what the rules of engagement are. The Israelis say these weren't deliberate targetings, but you have a deliberate policy, they're called the rules of engagement, which establish how a military, when it fires and to what extent it fires, what ammunition, what munitions it uses, all of that stuff. That's all policy, and that's a deliberate policy, and clearly it's a deliberate policy that's led to tens of thousands of women and children being killed and about 200 aid workers being killed. So it's a deliberate policy and it's killed a lot of people. And I hope that this must be transparently and independently investigated. It never is, by the way. I mean, I've been dealing with this issue since 2007, and there has never been a proper, independent, credible investigation by the Israelis. And not only, well, there was the Goldstone report in 2009.
But that was a UN-initiated, right?
It was, but it was an amazing report by this extraordinary international jurisprudential expert, Judge Richard Goldstone of South Africa, who is an extraordinary, he's a legal scholar, he's a practitioner, he's a South African judge on the Constitutional Court. I mean, he's legendary.
And he also happens to be Jewish as well, and he was very, very critical in the report, and then they tried to smear him. After
they didn't just try to smear him. I mean, Yuval Diskin, who was at the time the head of Shin Bet, went to Ramallah and said to President Abbas, if you don't squash this report, if you know, you must stop it being debated in the General Assembly, blah, 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 I will turn the West Bank into Gaza. Wow. So, you know, that's a matter of public record. I mean, the Israelis were very robust, shall we say, and brutal in killing off the Goldstone report. But, you know, what my point is that there has been one proper investigation.
Where they cooperated, maybe. Right.
No, they didn't, as a matter of fact, but it was still, you know, Goldstone did a superb report, but it never led to any accountability. And that's my point, that there's only ever been one, you know, attempt report. At proper.
Right. But it was never, But it was never an investigation done by the Israelis themselves. I mean, who investigates their own crime?
No, so they've never really handed over any evidence. So UNRWA staff, you know, through the decades have been killed, and UNRWA has never ever really found out from, you know, the Israelis have the intelligence records, they have all the military decision-making records, etc. That has never been given to UNRWA, the UN, or the families, and it's an absolute disgrace. But now maybe that we've got seven international, well, one of them actually that was killed was Palestinian, the Palestinian driver was killed, but six international staff, including three British people. And, you know, the British media are all over this. The Daily Mail, you know, the Parish Magazine of the Tory Party, the Daily Telegraph, you know, these are military personnel, British veterans, you know, who are very dear to the heart. Yeah, former, dear to the heart of the right-wing Tory press.
So maybe that will spur some sort of investigations and action because now...
Yeah, but will it lead to accountability? You know, will it really? Anyway, the British press are all over this and they're going to see this through. And Sunak is going to be under huge pressure. Of course, he may not be prime minister in 10 minutes' time. Who knows what his political fate is. But the fact is that the, you know, Downing Street, whatever that means, is going to be under huge pressure to make sure that there is accountability. There's personal criminal accountability, liability for this, that the people who are responsible for this need to be punished. Who knows? But I don't think there'll ever be accountability for the 32,000 and rising Palestinians, women and children who are being slaughtered in Gaza right now.
Well, I want to thank you, Chris Gunness, for being with us today on the True Talk radio show and podcast. Chris is the former spokesperson and head of strategic communication and advocacy for UNRWA. He's now currently the director of the Myanmar Accountability Project, which brings criminal cases against members of the Myanmar junta. And I hope that we can maybe have you back on to talk about that in the future, because obviously there's a lot of atrocities happening there as well. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing and for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Ahmed, to you, and best wishes to your audience. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is WMNF Tampa. At 10 Friday morning on WMNF's Down and Dirty, we will have a conversation about abortion being on the Florida's ballot. This is WMNF Tampa, 88.5 on the left side of your dial, best little radio station on planet Earth. Stay tuned for The Scoop.
طالت غيبتي الايام ضحكوا على شيبتي وشيبه ولا تشيبه ما حبوا طيبتي ناس تستنى في خيبتي والارنب طلع ذيبتي وشوف انا منهم خيبه قالوا يا الغاليه شلز شباب على ايطاليا لبحر وامواج العاليه وغرقين وغرقات وحمام